Well, good day, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is writer Joseph Pearce, who's chatting to us on the eve of his first speaking tour to Australia, sponsored by Hertford College of Sydney. Joseph is the internationally acclaimed author of many books, which include bestsellers such as The Quest for Shakespeare, Tolkien, Man and Myth, The Unmasking of Oscar Wilde, Literary Converts, and many more. Today we discuss his journey from far-right politics with the National Front in Britain in the 1970s and his conversion to Catholicism, what he makes of the current nationalist parties that have emerged in Europe over the last few years and how they compare to those he was associated with in his early life, his thoughts on Nietzschean vitalism, which has become popular among sections of the online right, and whether evangelization alone is sufficient to repair the West, and much, much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, Joseph Pearce, welcome to the NatCon Australia podcast.
It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. We're talking on the eve of your trip to Australia, which I think is going to take about 2 weeks and is sponsored by Hertford College of Sydney. I have been aware of you, as I was saying offline, for at least a decade. And I first came across your work in the book Literary Converts, which does a great job examining the personalities, predominantly British personalities, C.S. Lewis, Hilaire Belloc, G.K. Chesterton and the like, who, you know, their writing and their interactions and their examinations of their faith and the like. What I didn't know was your full backstory. And I think it'd be interesting to people, to my audience, to know a little bit about, you know, what you were doing at age 15 and where you, your transformation over the next sort of 10 years.
Yes. Yeah, so to give the full story, just to the context, I wrote a full-length book on my journey to the Catholic Church from white supremacism. And the title of the book is Race with the Devil, My Journey from Racial Hatred to Rational Love. So the key thing about that's the subtitle, A Journey from Racial Hatred to Rational Love, because what I came to realize was the Catholic Church, its insistence on the indissoluble marriage between faith and reason, fides et ratio, meant that love was not merely an emotion, but a rational choice. And we have to freely choose to lay down our life for the beloved, including the beloved who might be our enemy. So this was obviously a major transition from the 15-year-old boy who joined a white supremacist organization called the National Front in the mid-1970s. And I was very heavily involved in that organization for about 11 years and went to prison twice for what we'd now call hate crimes.
Mm. You always had a literary bent, though, is that right? Because you were writing for them at the time. You're clearly in interested in the world of ideas, even at that stage. You weren't simply a hooligan alone, you know, alone, although maybe there was aspects of that to your personality at the time, right?
Yeah, well, they sat somewhat uncomfortably side by side. I was certainly involved in the violent aspect of things because it was necessary, in a sense, if you either had to get the hell out of there or be willing to stand up for yourself, because they were violent times in the 1970s in England, you know, politically, but also football, absolutely the height of football hooliganism and everything else. So it was part of the culture. It was very, in some ways, things do get better. Many ways they get worse. Some ways they do get better. Thankfully, I learned from my father's knee a love of learning and a love of, I had a bad sort of formal education, but my father was self-taught loved history, loved literature and languages, taught himself sort of conversational German and knew smatterings of other languages. So I learned all that at home. So I had this love of learning, and then I fell in love with books. So I became a bibliophile and read a great deal. Now, the problem, of course, I became a bibliophile when I was in the middle of all this white supremacist ideology. So I read a lot of rubbish, which reinforced me in my bad ideas for several years before coming across certain writers. You mentioned G.K. Chesterton, Hilaire Belloc would be another, Alexander Solzhenitsyn was another very important influence upon me. So I started read people that allowed me to move beyond the place I was to somewhere better, basically.
Yeah. I mean, the radicalization of young men is still a topic of concern today. What is it about the ideas that sort of captivates a 15 or 16-year-old boy at that stage to go and join the National Front or to get involved in those types of movements, do you think?
Well, I think the key thing is, I mean, that's why I said that, you know, my journey from racial hatred to rational love is that hatred is always bad. And if you don't have charity, even if you're saying the right things, you're on the wrong side. And that's very, very important for us to realize. So the radicalization of young people is not necessarily a bad thing. The word radical just means looking for the roots of things, trying to find out what the root of a problem is so you can understand it and perhaps do something about it. There's nothing wrong with that per se. But if that radicalization goes hand in hand, a hand in glove with a hatred of one's enemies, perceived, what have you, then obviously it's bad, because if you're animated by hatred, you're animated by animus, right? Mm. Animosity, then you're not going to bring any good solutions. You're only going to contribute to the problem. That's the issue. Not that these, some ideas, I'm very opposed to globalism. I believe that national sovereignty is a good thing. I think that mass immigration is not a good thing. So these ideas haven't changed. But what's changed is the fact that I have no hatred in my heart to any individual person, and it's very, very important for us to love our neighbor. But the point is that we have to also understand that. Globalism, globalization is an evil, it's undemocratic, it's tyrannical, it's destructive of cultures and of history. And we have a right, and I would say a duty, responsibility to resist that.
Mm. So you wrote about literary converts. The exact way in which you were transformed during, I think, your time in prison, How did that happen? Was it you were exposed to, I think you said, G.K. Chesterton? Were there other, I don't know, acts of love or kindness or other events which sort of gradually transformed you?
Yeah, that's a great question, and there's a two-part answer, but I'll try to keep it brief. First of all, my generation, I think it's still very much part of the culture, is that religion is irrational. You have to basically choose between being rational or religious. You can't be both, right? So coming through Chesterton and then people like C.S. Lewis and ultimately to philosophers such as Thomas Aquinas, I came to understand that on the contrary, right, that the reason leads us to a belief in God, and then we can only know God so much by philosophy. If we're going to know God deeper, we need God to reveal himself to us. Has he? Yes, he has. So this is rational process. So that was very important. Now, I was convinced for many years after my conversion that it was an entirely rational process, but I was wrong. Because what was also happening at the time was healing. And that healing was connected to love. Now, obviously, ultimately, to the love of God himself. But I talk about it in my book, Race for the Devil, certain moments when my enemies, instead of hating me, now I was very comfortable with an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, right? You don't like me, I don't like you. We know what that means. If you attack me, I'm going to attack you. That was the language we spoke. So on those rare occasions when my enemy, instead of hating me, loved me. So I'll give just one example, perhaps. Back in the late 70s was the heyday of punk rock. And there was a band from Northern Ireland called Stiff Little Fingers, and the lead singer of that band was someone called Jake Burns, and he and I went on a live national radio show on Radio 1, BBC Radio 1, to discuss immigration and the problems of the day. I was there being belligerent, being my white supremacist self. And then afterwards, when we came downstairs in the lobby of the BBC, he shook my hand and said, "Do you want to come out for a pint?" So he took me to the pub, bought me a couple of beers, and he was actually a very affable, friendly person. And that caught me completely off guard, because this person who was my enemy was actually able still to love me. And so those sort of examples were very disarming. And I think they also planted seeds that person, even though I disagree with him, I can't not like him because he's a likable person.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, and you also, if I understand correctly, you didn't have a Catholic family. It wasn't as though you reverted to the faith that your parents had. You were actually quite, a nominally Protestant family that was associated with the Orange Order and all sorts of things. So why out of those competing identities on offer, you know, this strong nationalistic one that you're originally attracted to, why did you move then to Catholicism rather than, I don't know, evangelical Protestantism or Islam or something else?
Yeah, and again, another great question. I was raised typically English, by which I mean that, you know, in England, if you're not really sort of low life, you do have your children christened. So I was baptized into the Church of England, but we never went to church except for weddings and funerals. So never prayed at all ever, as a family or individually. So I was raised effectively de facto agnostic, but very anti-Catholic. Actually, I learned that from my father's knee as well. So it was nothing to do with religion. It was tribal. That the Catholics, you know, I bought into all the false English history, which we're raised with, about England being, that the Catholics being the enemy of England, which is absolute nonsense. I've written a book since called Faith of Our Fathers, History of True England, to show the true story. But of course, when you're young, you believe the nonsense. So I was very anti-Catholic. I was a member of the Orange Order. I was involved with the anti-Catholic terrorist organizations in Northern Ireland, the UBF and the UDA. I was very heavily involved in the politics of Northern Ireland for about 8 years. But why did I become a Catholic and not a Protestant or Muslim? Well, because of this process of faith and reason. You know, I wasn't interested in just buying into a religion. I wanted to find out what the truth was, right? This begins with philosophia, love of wisdom. I wanted to understand what the truth was. When I start looking at philosophy, you know, can faith and reason coexist? And when you start getting deeper into that, you do find yourself with Plato, Aristotle, St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, and, you know, via G.K. Chesterton, who I first interested in because of his politics, not because of his religion. But he got me, if you like, on that road to all of these other great philosophers. And then there's only one place to be after that, you know, it is the Catholic Church.
Yeah. I mean, some people in this day and age, online right personalities, also, you know, are interested in the Platos and the Aristotles and the like, but also there's this Nietzschean vitalism, which I think has attracted a lot of young people online. You know, they find attending church, or at least mainstream denominations, kind of in some ways overly effeminate, kind of weak and passive. They haven't been exposed to anything, an identity strong enough, which makes them think, oh, that's something I want to belong to. But this idea that, you know, you can... if we just get back to sort of the ethic of the Greek, the ancient pagan will to power, then that's something that's more attractive to it. And you do see it, I think, on the online right at the moment. There's, you know, you're probably aware, Bronze Age pervert is this online personality got, you know, he's been influential, I think, in Silicon Valley and amongst other people. And there's a general sort of flavor of the internet, which I think embodies that spirit. It's secular. It has this vital nature, and it's Nietzschean rather than Christian. What do you make of that? Was that around in the 70s or to the same extent?
Well, yeah, Nietzsche was one of my heroes. I mean, you know, that Nietzsche's teaching about the Übermensch, the Superman, the Overman, was inspired Adolf Hitler with all of his ideas of the master race. Now, the point is that the will to power is ultimately irrational. I mean, if Nietzsche says God is dead, he's also basically saying reason is dead, because what he's saying is the only thing that really matters is you, your own ego, and your drive for personal empowerment, self-empowerment. Well, that means there's no truth beyond your ego, egocentrism. Now, that is not a place for anybody to remain without becoming the same thing that Nietzsche did, which is quite frankly insane. So, no, that all you have to hope for if you're in that position is a stepping stone to somewhere better. Because ultimately, you have to engage with the world beyond your ego, that which is real, whether you want it to be or not. That is the engagement with objective reality. That's the process of reason. Once you start being rational, once you start using your reason, you get outside of your ego into better places.
Yeah. Do you think G.K. Chesterton and those writers from that time are still the best source for people trying to get out of this either identitarianism or Nietzschean vitalism outlook, or are there others, I guess, like yourself in this day and age that they should sort of tune into?
Yeah, I mean, Chesterton's wonderful, but if you know, quite frankly, Chesterton said, and I can give you a whole interview of Chestertonian aphorisms now, yeah. But, you know, Chesterton said that the coming peril was not Bolshevism, but standardization by a low standard. He said that in about 1930, that certainly come true. There certainly was a prophecy, but this standardization by a low standard, this dumbing down of everything to a lowest common denominator of radical relativist banality, is where we're at. And the trouble with that means a lot of people that are now suffering from the ADD, which is a consequence of text culture, you know, everything has to be a short or it has to, you know, short video, not longer than a minute, or if you can't say it in a tweet, then, you know, you're taking too long. Well, people with that ADD are going to find Chesterton difficult because he writes beautiful sentences that perambulate and wander, and they're beautiful. But unless you're able to apply your intellect for more than 30 seconds, you're not going to be able to read him. So I would say that probably, and I'm still recommending him, by the way, but, you know, that, yeah, certainly writers such as myself, but Peter Kraft, for instance, is a brilliant way of introducing young people in a very accessible way to these deepest ideas. So there are some contemporary Catholic philosophers and theologians out there that will allow people to go further, as C.S. Lewis would say, further up and further in. Because ultimately, anybody who's into self-empowerment is living in a more, they're golemizing themselves in The Lord of the Rings. Basically, the character of Gollum is a very realistic psychological portrait of someone who has nothing but themselves, right? They shrivel, they shrink. Ultimately, if you're going to get some real, should we say, moral muscle, you've got to get out of that golemized understanding of yourself into the real world.
Do you think it's possible to communicate these ideas through modern mediums like TikTok and, I don't know, Twitter and the like? Or is it you just have to hit the books in order to fully soak it up?
No, well, I've recently on my own, thanks to having a 17-year-old daughter, I've finally been dragged into the 21st century. And the last few weeks, I have my own YouTube channel, and she's filmed some shorts. And, you know, I can talk about some, you know, radical things in about 30 to 45 seconds. And just as an appetizer, it's only an appetizer. That's the point. All you have to do is hope that will invoke in someone a hunger to go more deeply, because you can't stay there. But the point is, if it prompts you to think outside the box, you can say something quickly, succinctly, aphoristically. Chesterton was very good at that. You know, I'll give you one example. We have a new pope to be elected imminently. What Chesterton says, we don't want a church that will move with the world. We want a church that will move the world. Well, there you are in 10 seconds, right? He said a great deal. So, yeah, there's a place for aphorisms, but it's not a stopping place. It's a stepping stone.
Yeah, just Chesterton, I think, would have been good on Twitter, X. He would have had it down to 150 or whatever characters. Just changing gears slightly, what do you think of these new nationalist parties in Europe? And to a certain extent in America, how do they differ from what was going on in the 70s? Are they an improvement, or are they just a rehash of the same thing?
Well, that's again a great question. The key element is that the European Union has metamorphosed since the 70s into a secular fundamentalist tyranny. So quite clearly that the individual nations within the European Union need to be standing up and demanding political liberty from basically a tyrannical regime run by the European Commission for the most part, which is not even elected. So the if you like, the natives getting restless and standing up to tyranny is a good thing. The test always is what animates them. Are they animated by hatred? Are they animated by something much more positive, such as a love of Western civilization, a love love of Christian civilization, a love of subsidiarity politically. I think that Viktor Orban in Hungary should start to use the word, which I completely agree with, sovereigntism. Right, you know, mm. the nations need to be sovereign. They actually have to have political liberty in order to actually exist as political entities. So, you know, things if you're animated by sovereignism or subsidiarity or a desire for localism, these are all good things. If you're animated by a hatred or racism, they're not good things. They're still good things. The things I said previously, they remain good things, but you poison them, basically. If you bring your hatred to these good things, hatred poisons everything it touches.
Mm. It strikes me, though, that these modern leaders, maybe Viktor Orban's the exception. He talks about Christianity more. Maybe Giorgia Meloni a little bit. She certainly talks about Western civilization. But they all do a little bit. But they're more secular than say the de Gaulles and the Adenauers and even the British politicians of say the '50s, and certainly they shun a little bit at the social issues, right? The Catholic life and issues. So is that something that is something that they will have to ultimately address, or is it something that it's not something we shouldn't require democratic leaders to get involved with? Or what's your attitude towards that?
Well, there's a saying which I think is very true, is that politics is downstream of culture. So, you know, politics is not ahead of the game, it's behind the game. So, you know, that these secular rulers are still very secularist in much of their moral philosophy. For instance, this Easter, there were record numbers of new converts being received in the Catholic Church in France and in England. And the other thing about it is the demographic is younger. It used to be 25 to 40 year olds was the common demographic of people being received in the church. It's now 18 to 25. So I think we're seeing a ground shift here and a groundswell of return to basically ultimately sanity. Sanity and sanctity, by the way, are ultimately the same thing because sin is stupid. So the point is that once we get this authentic Christian revival, which has to be done at the grassroots by ordinary people, the mainline politicians will fall in line 10 years behind the game. So I'm not really concerned that the current political leaders are reflecting the culture of 10 years ago. That's what they do.
Yeah, because there is one view that, and this is, I wrote an article about the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship. I attended 1 year, and what they espouse from the podium there is that, you know, clever people with clever thoughts and a re-evangelization or telling a different story, that's what we need to cure the moral ills of the West. And yet they kind of avoid, to a large extent, although they did a little bit better last year, immigration as a topic. And I always question whether it's with all the best will in the world and the most charismatic and well-versed sort of preachers or that you really stand a chance at changing, turning Britain into a more Christian culture if you have large, you know, mass immigration from people with very different cultures and religions, right? You just the odds are stacked against you. So there has to be a secular response rather than simply trying to think that there's going to be a miraculous St. Paul go out and head down to the, Muslim areas of London and suddenly baptize people en masse, right?
Well, I think there's two things. First of all, I would say as regards immigration, I think this would apply to all the countries of Europe. I can't speak for Australia, but it certainly applies to my own country, the United Kingdom. America, of course, is different because the African Americans have been here because of slavery for hundreds of years as a whole different scenario. But the 1948 British Nationality Act, just after World War II, began the opening, and we may as well use the word floodgates because that's what we're talking about, with millions of people. Mm. And no government, conservative or Labour, ever stood for parliament, ever had in their manifesto, vote for us and we will have immigration. In other words, there's no democratic mandate for any of that ever happening. It was basically imposed upon the British people without ever voting for it. So these things have to be addressed. But as regards, does this mean we can't have a Christian England now because of this all of this immigration? We forget, by the way, that Christianity is the largest religion in the world. And for instance, I'm a great I have a great devotion to Our Lady of Walsingham. It's a Marian apparition that happened in England in 1061, and I used to go there regularly when I lived in England, and I go back when I go back to the UK. I still try to go. The most popular, as in cars, pure numbers, a pilgrimage to Walsingham every year now is that by the Tamils. So basically, ethnically from the Indian subcontinent, but they're Catholics. They have a great devotion to the Blessed Virgin, and that's the largest pilgrimage. So the point is, it's not all doom and gloom because we have immigrants. On the contrary, actually, you know, the Catholic Church has been boosted in the past by immigration from Poland. Islam, militant Islam is an issue. But I also believe that basically that two or three generations of Muslims living in the UK are not going to have the really close ethnic religious ties to, say, Pakistan or whichever country they came from. And they're absolutely eminently evangelizable. I mean, the grandchildren of immigrants will be. So I this whole idea that you can't convert a Muslim, you might find it very difficult to convert a Palestinian living in Palestine, but apart from those who are Christian, but that's not true. It's not going to be true of anybody after two or three generations living in the UK. We can evangelize British culture, and evangelizing British culture will evangelize all people who are part of British culture.
The state is hostile. The British state, at least, is quite hostile to open Christian evangelization. I mean, you know, J.D. Vance, the Vice President of the United States, when he went to Europe recently, criticized, you know, freedom of speech and made examples of situations where, you know, praying in front of an abortion clinic or this, that was criminal. So, you know, it's a hostile environment in many ways, isn't it?
Yeah, but I actually think in some ways that's good. You know, that I think that, you know, that the worst thing for Christianity is getting in bed with the secular culture. The acceptance of suffering is at the heart of Christianity, the taking up of the cross. We're not meant to be at home in the world. We're meant to be evangelizing the world as those that are in a land of exile, a veil of tears, to use the words of the Salve Regina. You know, so the point is that there should be an edginess about Christianity. It should not be we're just going with the flow of the culture. Now, again, as Chesterton said, a dead fish floats downstream, only a living one floats against the stream, right? So we have to be accepting and embracing that the evangelization is going to involve martyrdom. You know, not necessarily, you know, people being killed for their faith, but certainly being persecuted for their faith.
Yeah. Do you think the Catholic Church, it's bingo the idea of subsidiarity, granted, but does it, what, the nation state, is it as comfortable with divisions between nations and the importance of the distinctive nations with their own individual identity?
Yeah, I think the first we need to clarify words such as division, because that's sort of an ambivalent term. You know, to divide can sound negative. You know, that we all want to be united, right? Alexander Solzhenitsyn said, and this is a metaphor that means a great deal to me, and it meant a great deal to me when I first read it many years ago, said the individual nations of God are unique flowers in the garden of culture. And he said, I oppose those who want to destroy all the different flowers and replace it with a single monoculture across the globe. You know, so multiculturalism, authentic multiculturalism, are authentic different national cultures. Not everybody playing the same world music with a little bit of this and a little bit of that, all sort of throwing everything in the same pot, and you get the same sort of global monocultural world culture. That's not cultural diversity. Cultural diversity is my going to Hungary and being able to experience Hungarian culture, which is something distinct from my going to the United States or Australia.
What's the argument, though, to those Catholics, and there's a large proportion of those involved in, you know, refugee organizations or immigration assistance organizations, that are very much involved in facilitating mass migration from different parts of the world into the first world. I mean, how to respond to that? Because they would obviously say, look, this is exactly what we should be doing, Christian charity and helping those in need and the rest of it. What's the Christian response to that?
Yeah, I mean, again, another very influential character, personality thinker on my own journey to Christianity was E.F. Schumacher, the great economist who wrote a book called Small is Beautiful in the early 1970s. And he actually, he called it intermediate technology. It's now called sustainable development or appropriate technology. But whatever the problems are that are causing people to want to migrate and get out, the answer is to solve the problems locally and sustainably. So if there's a big problem in a certain part of the world, we need to be sorting out what's happening in that part of the world, whether it's economic, cultural, political, and basically restore the culture, the politics, the economy at grassroots level. Let me give you one example of this, this example that Schumacher uses, that organizations like the International Monetary Fund will fund mega projects like a nuclear power station. So they fund a nuclear power station on the edge of Delhi in India. In consequence, the men folk leave the villages for 200 miles around radius to go and work in shanty town on the edge of the construction site of the nuclear power station. The villages are bereft of men. Family life is destroyed. Schumacher says, if you, the same amount of money that was invested in the nuclear power station, a generator was put in every village within 200 mile radius for the same cost, you could have sustainable local economies with sustainable local families with no major disruption. And that's what the whole idea of, you know, of mega macro globalist solutions to local problems actually makes the matters worse. That's the problem.
Yeah, but just to push on it, I mean, I think there is a divide in the Catholic Church between, for example, someone like Cardinal Robert Sarah, who's you know, looked on favorably by some section of the church, and then the Pope Francis kind of view of refugees, which is that they should be, you know, assisted wherever they, by whatever means they can be, to come to a better life in the first world. Is it possible really to sort of convince people within the church that these people would be probably better off staying in their own country, and we do more good doing good work there, building up their homeland? Is that I think there's the tough ask, right? I mean, that pushes against a lot of thinking in the church today.
Well, again, the big difference is, you know, that there's the label refugee can be applied to lots of people who aren't refugees, mm-hmm. right? That are political mm-hmm. migrants. I'll give you an analogous situation. The UK is a socialist country in terms of its social welfare, has been since at least World War II. I know people in England, personally, people in England who are my age, and I'm in my mid-60s, who have never done a day's work in their life. And it's not because they're disabled. It's because they've lived on welfare. I know one person who recently got a brand new car because they were disabled. Are these people unable to work? Are they just milking the system? And we live in a system that basically says, well, you know, if you can't find a job, we'll continue to support you forever for the whole entirety of your life. So same thing. Anybody who wants to move from one part of the country, one part of the world to another, can call themselves a refugee, right? That some of them will be refugees. And of course, there's a process of authentic discernment. You know, if someone's leaving a war zone, right, they're again, obviously a refugee. If someone's just moving mm-hmm. from a poor part of the world to a wealthier part of the world, they're economic migrants. There's a very big difference. And if we are not able to discern and distinguish, then obviously we're going to have a one-size-fits-all chaos, which is what we are now seeing in Europe.
Yeah. Look, you don't have to convince me of the arguments. I'm just trying to work out, as I'm sure you're aware, like there are people within the refugee agencies and the church and those who march under the banner of social justice or Catholic social teaching that will not agree with that kind of take on Christianity. And I and we'll be very much in favor of, you know, continuing the flow, and without realizing that it will, in my view at least, and I'm sure yours, bring catastrophic consequences to the sort of countries in which they reside.
Dan, I mean, I just to follow up that, I wrote something fairly recently in response to somebody in the Curia saying that the church should not be building walls. I used a metaphor that basically I live in a home. The home has walls. The home has walls to keep the elements out when the weather's bad. It also has walls to keep wild animals out. It has walls to keep potential intruders out. And my door has a lock in it for the same reason. So the door is a bridge. It allows me to love my neighbors, allows me to invite my neighbors into my house, but it also has a lock on it. That is common sense. And I talked about this chap in the Curia. I said, you know, there's a wall surrounding the Vatican. And the only place you can get into the Vatican is through St. Peter's Square. And you've got lots of security people. And why? Because there are people that might want to come in there and do harm. So, of course, there's a place for walls, right? There's a place for bridges as well. But even the bridges have to be drawbridges, right? They have to have locks on, because if you don't want people to just be able to walk in freely and cause chaos, you have to be able to stop that happening.
Yeah, I'll look, and there's plenty of examples, biblical stories of people building walls and, you know, ensuring that the kingdom is safe from intruders and all the rest of it. Just on England, because I know you're from there originally and you've written about it extensively. What is the short story for why England, to be true to itself, should get back to its Catholic roots?
Well, again, the easiest way to answer that is to refer people to the full-length book I wrote on the subject, Faith of Our Fathers, A History of True England, which begins with the arrival of the first Christian missionaries, which according to tradition is 63 AD. And that's entirely believable, because that's, you know, within 10 years or 15 years of the Romans arriving, and that's the way Christianity spread. So basically, Catholic missionaries came to England in the first century. England was a profoundly Catholic country in an uninterrupted way until the 16th century. And then it was ripped and ruptured from the church, not because the people wanted it, but because King Henry VIII nationalized the church and made himself head of it. And then we have 300 years of the intense persecution of the Catholics, including hundreds of martyrs, many of whom are now canonized. And that's for me, those dark days are actually the most glorious days of English history, those days of resistance to this tyranny that's been imposed upon England by secularism. Henry VIII, it's a secularist takeover. It's not a Protestant takeover. And then we have this wonderful Catholic revival in the 19th century, heralded by St. John Henry Newman's conversion. Then we have these great literary converts that I wrote about in the book you mentioned, this great revival. And so, you know, my hope is 21st century, we'll see another revival. Already now, the Catholic Church is the largest Christian denomination in England, largely because the Anglican Church is imploding. It's imploding because it is doing what Chesterton said the church shouldn't do. It's not moving the world, it's moving with the world. It's just basically become part of the secular culture. Why bother? Well, you have plenty of other aspects of secular culture you can go to without going to the Anglican Church. If anybody wants authentically Christianity, they go to the authentic Christian church, which is the Catholic Church.
Yeah. You're coming to Australia, I believe, for the first time. And one thing that's been different about our history is that there has been, at least until recent times, a large percentage of the population that was Catholic, predominantly Irish Catholic, about 40% was usually the figure given. Whereas in England, still until about the 70s or thereabouts, it was still a, you know, what, 90% Protestant country, more or less nominally Protestant country, right? And so I still think when I talk to my English friends that they, you know, there's never been a Catholic Prime Minister of the UK. Well, there's been stacks of them in Australia. It's still baked in to the sort of systems of government, this low-level anti-Catholicism. You can have a Hindu prime minister, but a Catholic one would be a bridge too far, right? But so how would it in practice sort of roll out this, you know, change from England into a Catholic state once more?
Well, you know, if you were to go back, this is one of the glories of understanding history. It allows us to see our own time from the perspective of all times, if you like, other times. If you were to go back 200 years to 1825 in England, so 4 years before the Catholic emancipation, there were, by this stage, only a few tens of thousands of Catholics in England, because there'd been a war of attrition at this point for 300 years solidly. Very heroic resistance, but bit by bit by bit. And if you were sort of a realist in 1825, you said, well, the Catholic Church is finished. And yet by the end of the 19th century, I give the figures in my book, but there were a few dozen Catholic churches in the country. By the end of the century, there were a few hundred. Beginning of the century, there were two or three Catholic schools. By the end of the century, there's 200 or 300 Catholic schools. So, you know, the transition in Victorian England, and in various reasons for that, I won't go into all of it, but part of it, you know, obviously you have the higher echelons of society, many of them converting, like John Henry Newman and Cardinal Manning and others, right? Gerard Manning Hoxie's great literary converts. But also you had the Irish potato famine and the Irish diaspora. And of course, the Irish, they went to America, they went to Australia, but many of them came to England. So you also had, if you like, to use a Marxist terminology, an Irish Catholic lumpen proletariat moving in. So you had, the working class, but you also had the intelligentsia. So it's like a pincer movement. So that so the Catholic Church, and between the two world wars, there was on average, I did this research when I was doing literary converts, there were an average in excess of 10,000 adult converts every year. Because between the two world wars, the Catholic Church, because of, well, not just because, but one of the reasons the Catholic Church's social teaching was seen as an alternative to the rise of communism and to the rise of fascism. That, you know, is there a sane alternative? Yes, the Catholic Church is the sane alternative.
Yeah. You read the stories of, and about the influx of new Catholic converts in the UK and how the youth are attracted to it. But then proportionally there's so much of a larger Muslim population growing, and it's sort of, and also, if you step back, as in terms of a percentage, it's a far less Christian society than the UK was, say, in the 1950s than it is today. So those you're increasing off a very small base. So I don't know. It's optimistic to think that will kind of eventually sort of take over.
C.S. Lewis then talks about Christianity and water. The basin. Or the Christian basin was much larger in the 1950s, but it was very much Christianity and water. What we actually need is a distillation of the true spirit, and it's that which will actually convert the culture, something which is real and not just going with the flow. I mean, Anglicanism in the 1950s is part and parcel of the fabric of the British state, right? But we don't want that. We want an evangelical Catholicism which will actually convert the culture towards radical Christian principles, and that's only if you don't dilute your Christianity with the spirit of the age. Ultimately, we have to choose between the Holy Spirit, the spirit of the age, the Heidegger Geist, the Zeitgeist, and you can't choose both. That just makes you schizophrenic. You have to choose one or the other.
Yeah. Do you think there are many Catholic parishes and masses which are more in touch with the spirit of the age than the spirit of the Holy Spirit, because, you know,
absolutely. That was a big problem, particularly in the 1970s, 80s, and of course in many parishes still today. I'm enough of a realist, but I travel a great deal giving talks. It's true that perhaps the most sort of liberal, secular, fashionable, zeitgeist driven parish is probably not going to invite me. That's certainly true, probably. But the key thing I sometimes talk about the election of Pope St. John Paul II in 1978 as being the turning point. And there's a wonderful two lines in Chesterton's poem, The Ballad of the White Horse, when basically the pagan Danes are invading. They look as if they're going to be victorious, and it's the last stand of the Christian Saxons under King Alfred the Great. And then there's two lines: the high tide, King Alfred cried, the high tide and the turn. And that's what I really think with St. John Paul II getting elected, and then when he gets Cardinal Ratzinger as his right-hand man, that dynamic duo certainly begin to turn things around. And I think they've turned around since then. I think things are much healthier now in the church, liturgically, for instance, at a parish level, than they were 50 years ago.
In Catholic Church, you think, in England?
Yeah.
What do you hope for the next pontiff?
One that will help to build a church that will move the world and not move with it.
Yeah, and I guess no one really knows what goes on in the conclave, and there is a betting market, I think, actually. I'm not sure that's a grave sin or not. I haven't had, a ruling on that, but they do exist. But yeah, are there any favorites of yours, or it's not really something worth speculating too much about?
I one of the reasons that I managed to sort of live relatively angst-free, anxiety-free, is not worrying about things beyond my control. I'm not a cardinal of the church. I'm going to certainly hope that I pray every day. That's maybe the micro. I pray every day. Now, I ask actually for the intercession of St. John Paul II and Benedict XVI for the cardinals in the conclave, that they will follow the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, and elect a pope in accordance with the will of God. And then I pray the Our Father, so thy will be done, deliver us from evil. And that's what I can do. Beyond that, I can't do anything else. So I'm doing my bit. That's all I can do.
Yeah.
I suppose I can be fasting and saying rosaries and everything else. But I'm a miserable loser of a sinner. So,
Yeah. Sufficient unto this day the evil thereof, right? You can not worry about so many things. Are there any other people who've taken a similar journey to you from, far-right nationalist party member to now Catholic convert and evangelist?
Well, one good thing about being out there and outspoken and publishing books is I get emails from all over the world, from all sorts of people, but that includes many people who have been on a similar journey that have both in the UK, in the United States, even actually in Australia, someone who was a radical Muslim that's now on the journey to Catholicism or was when he last wrote to me. So, yes, I'm very aware of people that have made similar conversion. I'm aware of at least one who was involved in a white supremacist organization, who's now a Catholic priest. Absolutely. I'm not unique, thanks be to God.
What do you know of Australia? You're about to hop on a plane, I think, in 48 hours' time to come out here. What are you anticipating?
Well, it's a blissful ignorance. Hopefully, it's also a blissful innocence. So it's not a blissful arrogance, anyway. I know very little about Australia. I mean, to be honest with you, I know that the Australians always beat the English at cricket and rugby, so that's always sort of a bit of a chip that we bear, inferiority complex perhaps, as we got sport. But
you've been in the States 20 years, right? And you still talk like an Englishman and carry the necessary sporting grudges that will stand you
right. I bear the scars.
But Australians in America or in your circles, have you come across those that have impressed you or that have been influential or the writings that you've thought, should be?
Yeah. Funnily enough, because in England, well, certainly when I lived in London, you'd bump into Aussies and New Zealanders all the time, and they're doing their sort of annual walkabout, and I'm sure if I lived in somewhere like New York City, it would probably be the same. But living here in the upstate of South Carolina, I very rarely see Australians, to be honest with you. Now, Matt Fadd is someone that I've become friends with, and I've appeared on Matt Fadd's show a couple of times, and obviously he's made a big name for himself over here. So thanks be to God for him. But generally speaking, I actually meet very few Australians and New Zealanders. It's because I'm sort of in what you might call a bit of a backwater, the upstate of South Carolina. It's very, very, very vibrant as regards to the Catholic Church, very good things happening. But we moved here because it's a bit like the Shire. I spent my bad years in London And I just swore I'd never live in a big city again. And so I'm always looking for the proverbial shire. In England, I moved to Norfolk. I lived in some beautiful small towns and villages in Norfolk. Moved to the States, and this is I'm looking out the window now. We got 2.5 acres. We've got a meadow there, a creek, a bank of trees. I mean, you know, it could be worse.
Yeah, you've written a lot on J.R.R. Tolkien, and I think recently the Home Secretary in the UK put the Lord of the Rings as one of the books which was people who expressed too much of an interest in J.R.R. Tolkien were likely to have far-right extremist views. I'm not sure if you saw that story. I mean,
no, it doesn't surprise me that sort of people that are governing the UK at the moment would have that view. The point is that for me, that the Shire is about localism. The answer to the problems of politics is not big power. It's not Isengard. It's not Mordor. If you want political freedom, you have to defend the place where you are from encroachments upon it by political forces that are enemies of your way of life. And if that sounds like far right perspective, then well, Tolkien's right, and the socialist government of the United Kingdom are wrong.
Yeah. What are you working on now? What are you writing about? What are the things that interest you sort of going forward?
Well, so the book that I'm sort of working on, two books simultaneously. I'm writing a series for Crisis Magazine on unsung heroes of Christendom. So, you know, it speaks for itself, right? The heroes of Christian culture that are not as well known as they should be. But I'm also working on a book. I haven't given it a definite title yet, but something like Winning the War of Words, Defending the Definite, or something like that. Basically, to define terms such as culture, love, civilization, so that we actually have a vocabulary that we're not sort of falling into ambivalence. Because when people use the word like love, well, unless you know what we mean, let me give you one practical example. That for a Christian, love is a rational choice. It's freely choosing to lay down your life for the beloved, irrespective of what you feel about them. Nothing to do with feeling, right? Mm-hmm. The feeling we have towards our enemy or our spouse, hopefully you're different, our children, right? Our neighbors. So, but we're still called to rationally choose to lay down our lives. It's a rational choice. But for the wider world, the secular world, love is an emotion. It's a feeling. Largely, it's a feeling which passes through the loins, and it is therefore ipso facto irrational, which means that I should be able to do what I feel, right? And it has nothing to do with reason whatsoever. These are absolutely antithetical. For one is, I will lay down my life for you. The other, I want you to lay down your life for me, right? My love and what I want to do requires you doing what I want, right? Well, that's very different from me doing what I need to do to lay down my life for you.
Hmm. Yeah. So that is part of what you're writing about with the Christian unsung heroes. Is that?
No, this is the other book I'm writing about, defining terms, basically. This vocabulary. How do we understand these key terms in discourse? Right. We have, you know, the culture wars. It's obviously a war of words, amongst other things. Well, we have to understand what these words mean. And if the two different sides in the abysmal divide have two different definitions of the same word, we have to know what both those definitions are and know the difference.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Just to double back one more time, I mean, in the UK at the moment, there's this Netflix film called Adolescence, which is scaring the bejesus out of mums that their sons are, you know, 13-year-old sons are going to become radicals. And it just strikes me, at least in all the kind of commentary, that amongst all their de-radicalization programs, there's nothing that, you know, they're not proposing to send people to church or to reinvigorate Christian teaching. It's much more amorphous and sort of therapeutic, the remedies that they're proposing.
Which won't work. That's not how it won't work. I mean, it won't work because it hasn't worked. I mean, that's exactly the approach they've had to social problems for the last 150 years, and look at the consequences.
Yeah. I just think that approach wouldn't have worked for a young 15-year-old in the 70s, right?
I treated it with contempt, that speaking basically liberal psychobabble to me as a way of explaining me away, you know. Even as a 15-year-old, that was patronizing. It's not going to work.
Yeah, and people are even better these days at sort of pulling apart sort of attempts at propagandizing to them. And, you know, I think that's the challenge, though, in some ways, isn't it? Because they're very good at, they're just young people are being inundated with sort of messages and savvy marketing, and they react to any type of attempt at persuasion in a kind of negative way. So even the good stuff, I think you have additional challenges to try to get through to them with.
Yeah, I mean, I think St. Francis of Assisi, when he says, you know, preach always, if necessary, use words. In other words, that ultimately that what's going to win people to Christ is holy lives. That we have to begin with ourselves. We have to grow in faith and in love. And that has to be manifest in just the way we live our lives, including what we say and what we write. And that goodness, by the grace of God, because of course we can't get that goodness without His help, that goodness by the grace of God will be the light that shines in the darkness of these people's lives. So they're living in the basement, spending their time with porn and video games, right? As Oscar Wilde said, we're all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars. Right. We need to get people to say, look, you don't have to be face down in the gutter. Right. You might not be able to get out of the gutter yet, but at least look up. Right. And once they start looking up, they're seeing that what's up there is much better than what it was when I look face down. Right. And so this is it's very easy, I think, to convert this culture because they're in a bad place and they don't like the bad place they're in.
Yeah. Hey, Joseph, Piers, I've enjoyed a discussion. If people want to read more about all the stuff that you've written and the books and everything else and the videos that you do, what's the best way for them to find that? And I'll pop it on the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the best one-stop place for me is my personal website. That's jpearce.co, jpearce.co, not .com. It's got the blog, it's got my Inner Sanctum, where I post podcasts, exclusive podcasts. It's also got book tag. It's books tag. So all of my books, you can go to the tag and it will give a direct link to the publisher. And that's the best one-stop place for everything I'm doing, basically.
Mm. Yeah, great. Well, look, I wish you well on your trip to Australia. I think I'll be coming to Brisbane, so we'll meet in person, no doubt. And I hope it's everything you hope for and more.
Thank you. Well, it's been a joy talking to you. I hope we do get a chance to meet in the flesh when I'm down under.
Sounds good, mate. Thanks very much. Leave you to it.
Thank you.
Bye.